It's really nice to be here with you all today. I missed one of my favorite services of the year, the January 1st service when we do the fire communion. And so for me, this is like my New Year's service back with this congregation, and it really feels like a gift to be here. Except that they're still celebrating in Puerto Rico, where I was. They're still celebrating Christmas, that is, still. It's still going on. My family just spent some time there, and none of the trees came down on January 1st. Not a single one. The trees in Puerto Rico stay up until February 1st, maybe March 1st. We are told that there's a tradition of spray painting them green once they turn brown, and all the needles have already fallen off. In the 50 United States, we like to get down to business much faster than in Puerto Rico. There's time for the party, there's time for celebration, but then January 1st rolls around and it's all about renunciation. What will you give up this year? Have you noticed the way our retail stores arrange themselves during the build-up to the Christmas season? The first things you see when you walk in the door are all of the extravagances. The chocolates, the cashmere sweaters, the giant bottles of champagne. And then January 1st rolls around and there's cleansing teas and juice fasts and exercise clothing as soon as you walk in the door. The turnaround is like that. This past Friday was the Epiphany. The neighbors that my family met in Puerto Rico were, I'm certain, celebrating. They invited Reverend Scott and I to celebrate with them on New Year's Eve at their all-night New Year's Eve party, and they invited us back the next day to celebrate with their all-day New Year's Day party. And then if we had stayed, we would have been there again for the 6 days of the Three Kings, and then the Epiphany party, and then for that week of parties that they have no name for, but they party anyway. Here on Christmas Day, intern John and I were already making the turn from celebration to work, weren't we, John? We were reminding the gathered community on Christmas morning of the work of Christmas. Sure, there's time for all that silent night stuff round yon manger, but that's for Christmas Eve. Christmas Day rolls around and we're down to business. When the song of angels is stilled, says Howard Thurman, when the star in the sky is gone, it's time for the work of Christmas to begin, to find the lost, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among the people, and to make music in the heart. Amen. But that's not all easy work, is it? That's all the hard stuff to do. This nation's spiritual forebears were Puritans. Enough said. We're more comfortable with work than we are with celebration. On Friday, our dear friends in Puerto Rico were likely back to karaoke and hopefully also cutting their Three Kings cake. I'd like a Three Kings cake. Why, when some of the world is consuming King's cake, are we donning exercise gear, pledging juice fasts, moving on to the work of Christmas and renunciation in all its forms? Why? Why do we do this to ourselves? Intern John and I have similar New Year's rituals. We don't do New Year's resolutions. We do, however, call them different things. I hear you say mantra. I say mantra.
Yeah,
oh, I thought it was it was one of those you say tomato, I say tomato moments when I heard you introducing it today. Well, mantras and mantras, whatever they are, we both do them. They are reminders, and they are in their very nature guilt and shame free. You build a mantra, you create one because you know you'll have to return to it again and again and again because you know you're not going to get it right. That's what a mantra is. It's not a diet. It's not a juice fast. It's a reminder. These are the words we will say to ourselves, the words that we will use to call ourselves back again to our purpose in January, when the world grows cold and dark, and then again in March, when the winds and the rain break our spirits, and then again in May, when the flowers cannot cover the weight of the year's loss, and then again in August, when we realize again that the work of Christmas is not done, nor will it ever be done completely. We use our mantras as prayers, as meditations, even as celebrations, again and again, but not ever as renunciation. This may sound odd, given that my mantra is no guilt, no shame, no excuses. It is about no's, but it's not about giving these things up. It's about clearing the fog, or as I like to say, about getting past the stupid. I find that helpful. I like to get past the stupid. Sometimes that's what I need to do. Let's start with guilt. As intern John said, it's not all bad if it's a means to an end. Have you ever been in a group conversation when guilt is mentioned and then it becomes a competition? Everyone reacts one after the other. You should hear about the Catholic guilt that I had to hear growing up. No, you should hear about the Jewish guilt that my family used. No, it's the Christian guilt, that's the worst. The progressive family guilt, the conservative family guilt. It goes around and around. Guilt is a universal currency. Even the Buddhists have their form, I'm sure. I imagine a Buddhist monk sitting with a mantra in his head or her head, and then suddenly it becomes one of these. The hands just switch. The guilt is there for all of us, no matter how hard we work on letting it go. And as Unitarian Universalists, we have our own particular guilt currency. It sounds like this. Have you, have I, have we done enough to save the world? And Unitarian Universalist guilt, it looks like a person leaving the grocery store, balancing 10 cans of cat food in their hand because they forgot to bring a shopping bag. Anybody else? That happens to me all the time. We always want to be able to do that one more thing right. This guilt is fine if it is a currency. It works when it's traded quickly, when it passes through us, doing its work, reminding us that we have failed, but that we are always working to grow and develop. Guilt is the feeling when we recognize that we've done something that maybe if we'd thought about it a little bit more, we might not have done, but who has the time for all that thinking? This kind of guilt, this guilt as currency that passes through us, it's a sign of psychological health. We recognize that we do have an impact, that what we do matters. This is the opposite of indifference. And when it leads to acts of apology or change or growth or understanding or just breathing in and breathing out and letting it go, then it serves us. It's the difference between accidentally cutting off another driver and waving to say, "I'm sorry," or accidentally cutting off another driver and a waving in a very different way to say something completely else. Guilt helps when it's not a punishment, but a reminder. I've got an image for you. A wire fence ran between our property and our neighbors in my childhood home. The wire fence was there to remind us of the boundary between the two spaces. The trees that grew along that fence were old oaks, and they were planted there when the property lines were drawn. Some began to subsume the fence, to grow around it, to take it into their bark and then into their wooden flesh. Imagine the fence as the boundaries that we keep, that when we cross, we feel guilt. The feeling of the wire pressing into our arm, That is the feeling of guilt, that we are pressing into a boundary that is uncomfortable to our conscience. The boundary serves us to recall us to our best selves, but if we get stuck there, stuck on the fence, unable to forgive ourselves for crossing that boundary, whether it was our choice to cross it or not, we begin to hold on to the burden of guilt. And if we stay there long enough, the guilt might grow into us like a fence and become a permanent hindrance to our peace. Does that image work for you? That image speaks to me. So what do we have to do? We have to do one of those mea culpas and let it go. And let it go because the permanent hindrance that could be called shame. And that's not so easy to let go. Guilt is, I've done something wrong. Shame is, I'm wrong. Shame feels the same for men and women, but it's organized differently. I find this really intriguing. For women, shame is, do it all, do it perfectly, and never let them see you sweat. Any nods around the room? Shame for men, and I should say those who identify as men, shame is, do not be perceived as weak. Does that one connect? The Jungian analysts call shame the swampland of the soul. When the counselor Brené Brown won acclaim for her TED Talk on vulnerability and shame, she was invited to speak with a variety of audiences. Many that approached her said how happy they were to hear more, but please do not bring up shame. Don't talk to us about that. We can't hear anymore. There's been work afoot to rebuild the American conversation on race. The stumbling block, I believe, is shame. You can't talk about race without talking about inequality and privilege. The different privileges that we all have, unique to our own selves, and the big privileges that some have across our society, whether it's white privilege or male privilege or economic privilege. But when we talk about privilege, we feel it as shame. Shame that we have received something we don't deserve. Shame that who we are, indeed our very skin, is complicit in inequality. And until we are brave enough to sit with that shame so that we can see it for what it is, the mud, the muck, the swampland that is holding us and our nation down, I believe we will remain paralyzed. That's why my mantra's center, its core, is no shame. Not that I hope to evict all the shame from my soul. That's a life's work, maybe 10 lives' work. But what I can work on is preventing shame from steering me. A dear friend posted on Facebook that he's been talking to himself a lot of late. He just finished chemo treatments for a malicious cancer. He's healed temporarily. When he was sick, he spent all his time talking to his cancer and listening to what his cancer was saying back. He was saying, I'm going to win, I'm going to beat you, and his cancer was just giving him aches and exhaustion. That was the conversation. Now that he's in remission, he's listening to something else, and for him, he calls it that still small voice that's reminding him to love himself, to reach out to others, and to spend time with friends. The voice of his cancer is stilled. If he can still that, perhaps we can also still the voice of shame and listen to that other voice within, that voice of conscience. Shame says, when you want to live out some dream, imagine something that you've wanted to do forever, some dream you have. Shame says, you're not good enough. You've never done it before. You don't know what to say. You're too strange. You're different than everyone else. You're not the kind of person that people like. That's the voice of shame. It helps me when I picture shame as Statler and Waldorf. Anybody remember them? You might not remember their names. They are the critics from the Muppets. The critics who would sit on the side of the Muppet stage and say terrible things the whole Muppet show. I picture shame as Statler and Waldorf. Statler would say, "They're not half bad." Join in if you know this. Waldorf would answer, "No, they're all bad." And they would erupt into laughter. But sometimes even Statler and Waldorf, would find a way out of the swampland. Statler would say, "Boo." Waldorf would say, "Boo." Statler would say, "That's the worst thing I ever heard." Waldorf, "It was terrible." Statler, "Horrendous." Waldorf, "Well, it wasn't that bad." Statler, "Oh yeah?" Waldorf, "Well, there were parts of it I liked." Statler, "Well, I liked a lot of it." Waldorf, "Yeah, it was good, actually." Statler, "It was great. It was wonderful. Yeah, bravo, more, more, more." Breaking free from shame is about redirecting our attention away from the pain to the places of beauty. It's also about finding a place to laugh at ourselves in there for being so critical. I was taught young through example and direction that I should look clean and presentable. Coming back from Puerto Rico, I had a chocolate bar. I was nervous when I opened it. I was wearing a white skirt and a light gray sweater. But we'd missed lunch and I was really hungry. At the end of the flight, I noticed a drop of chocolate on my skirt. How'd that get there? Then another smear on my arm. Yep. And then a whole lot more chocolate on the armrest. And then a whole mess more that I had been sitting on in my white skirt. Shame. It's like the messiness of who we are is suddenly right there on the outside for everyone to see. Then I noticed that a child was looking at the mess that I had made, a child that had been seated right near me. And the child smiled and laughed a little bit. And I smiled back and said, "I'm a mess, aren't I?" Laughter. I liked that laughter a lot. It was beautiful and it was saving. Statler, "That was all bad." Waldorf, "Well, there were some things I like. I liked. Bravo, bravo." Please, my good work of Christmasers, when the work of Christmas begins to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, and you end up with chocolate all over your skirt, just remember, you can be so funny sometimes. Make yourself a king cake. Don't let the guilt or the shame that you feel from not saving the world prevent you from loving it as well as loving yourselves. A past mantra of mine was very simple. It was just the single word, child. Child. It helped me remember that I'm a child of the universe, a child, I say, of God, to remind me that I am not all-powerful, not all-knowing. A mantra is a mantra because it is meant to be repeated. We need to be recalled to ourselves again and again. So, child, go make yourself a king cake. And amen.